Good afternoon. So today we're going to continue to talk about pipelining. We're going to look at taking our pipeline ideas that we started with our simplistic only doing ads processor and moving that into applying it to our full processor with everything and all the instructions. And I mentioned, you know, I finished up last time talking about a naming convention we have, which is that we're going to name the parts of our pipeline register based on the signal that the stage that the signal that goes in or out of it belongs to. So the input signals we're going to name with a lowercase letter, the output signals we're going to name with uppercase letter, and prefix based on the stage they belong to. This means that when we look at the code for a particular stage, like here, we'll be mostly dealing with values prefixed with the letter of the stage. So we're writing the code for decode, we're reading values from the fetch to decode registers. Those signals, those outputs of those registers are noted with a capital D, and we're writing to values with a lowercase d to send things to the next stage. That's the name of our decode to execute register inputs. And in HCL, the way we declare register banks like this is lowercase f uppercase d makes lowercase f be the input prefix, uppercase d be the output prefix. This is conventionally how we'll write fetch to decode register banks. It's what I would recommend doing when we have assignments where you do this, but we just care that it executes the instructions correctly. If you want to use different names, we won't stop you. But it would probably be very confusing. So that means that our basic process for taking our sequential processor and making it a multi-cycle processor is every look at the code for each stage, make it use pipeline registers, input or outputs everywhere. You just convert the code to use those pipeline register input outputs every time that we need to pass something to another stage instead of accessing it directly. And you just declare the pipeline register, so you just need to figure out what those are. So you just need to clear all of them, figure out what's in every pipeline register. We'll talk later about how you figure out what you put here, what needs to go there in a more systematic way. But first, let's look at, you know, given that this is our general process, and we had what we did for the ad processors, we just divided it up into stages and divided each stage by pipeline registers. Let's look at doing that for our full processor and see what happens. So I have here a picture of our full single cycle processor, and I've marked, just like I did with the ad processor when we started, where are the components that deal with each of the stages, which we've decided are what we're going to make each step of our pipeline. We could have divided it up differently, but this is what the book chose. It's what we're going to use. So I've marked where each of the stages are. And to start out, we have a problem we also have with our ad processor. And that's that sometimes we pass values from one stage to a stage which is not the next stage. So with this as drawn, we are passing values from fetch to decode for an instruction, and also from fetch to write back. In our single cycle processor, this is no problem, because when instructions in fetch, it's also in write back and decode. No problem, values should be passed that way. But when we turn this into our pipeline processor, we want values to go from fetch to decode, where they're going to go to a register, which is going to make them wait until the next cycle to advance, and then decode to execute, then execute to memory, then memory to write back. We don't want them to go to fetch, from fetch to decode and write back, because a different instruction needs to go to write back. So we're going to make a different decision here. We want to make it so we go to decode, then execute in memory, and so on. So to facilitate turning this into a pipeline processor, I'm first going to redraw this to obey this rule. I just moved wires around, which makes things a lot uglier. But now, instead of sending things directly from fetch to destem and desd, we go through decode, and then through execute, through memory, through write back to do it. And similarly, instead of sending a value from the ALU to the register file, we send it from the ALU through the memory stage to the register file and write back. So this is just redrawing. I didn't change what any signals do. I just redrew it to prepare us for pipelining. So now the way this is drawn, things go from one stage to the other for a particular instruction. We have signals that still cross between stages and not from one stage to the next, but these are cases like from through write back to fetch, where it's okay because that's a case where we want to choose what instruction to run next. It's not about the same instruction. Well, but that seems to pose a bit of a problem, which we'll get to later. But we can't keep, it makes sense that we're not communicating from one stage to the next in that case because it's about what's the PC next for a different instruction. So now that we've done this, we need to add pipeline registers because we need to make it so that we, when we're running fetch, we compute the values that we need for decode, then wait until the rising edge of the clock, and then start doing that in decode and at the same time do another instruction fetch. So we need pipeline registers between every pair of stages. So the way I've drawn it, I just draw a line between the stages. Everything that crosses goes in a pipeline register. That's one sort of way of figuring out what it's going to need to be in a pipeline register. You just draw everything the processor needs, which is kind of hard, actually, because it gets very busy. Everything that crosses between the two stages needs to go in a pipeline register. And, you know, we also have some control logic, and that's a bit of a problem. We'll get to what that looks like in a bit. But, you know, I didn't draw, for example, the inputs to any of the muxes here. And where they come from might need to change because we did pipelining. So we'll talk about that in a bit. But this is our basic idea, and when we're doing this, whether writing in HCL or, you know, drawing the picture, we're obeying these rules about how our pipeline stages work. Our pipeline stages read the prior stage's output to know what instruction was passed to them and send inputs for the next stage. That's most of their job. And they also, you know, do things that are deliberately not obeying this one stage to the next rule when we want to communicate values between instructions. For example, we write to the register file because we want another instruction to read it. That doesn't use the pipeline registers, but that's because it's a side effect of the instruction. We change the PC of a different instruction because we want to choose what instruction gets run, for example, in a jump or return. Those are exceptions, but otherwise it's read from the prior stage's outputs, write to the next stage is the routine of our writing a pipeline circuit. So let's go through the issue of control logic. So I told you that, you know, that picture I showed you, I didn't draw any of the control logic. And one question is, do we need to actually change our control logic based on now that we have a pipeline now, we don't have a single cycle processor. So let's think first about some control logic for our single cycle processor. So if you remember, our data memory has an input about are we reading and are we writing. And normally, in our single cycle processor, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the I-code, the instruction memory's output, the current instruction, and we're going to decide, okay, it's an MR move queue, I need to read. It's an RM move queue, I need to write. So we're going to have some logic which looks at the I-code, figures out whether it's one of those instructions that modifies or reads memory, and if so, it's going to send one to the data memory, otherwise it's going to send zero. So can I use this logic for our pipeline processor? Can I just keep this the same? I've written some HCL code that does this. Is that going to change? People are nodding. Anyone want to volunteer an explanation as to why things would need to change? So, yeah.
I mean, you could have a data hazard, which means you're reading and writing something.
Okay, so you're worried about hazards. So hazards are something related to this, but they're not the biggest problem. We'll talk about hazards in a bit, but hazards are not the biggest issue with this. So there's a more fundamental problem with just having this wiring. nice picture here. So the I code from the instruction memory is for whatever instruction we're currently fetching. That is almost certainly not the same instruction we're currently doing the memory stage of. So if I have an RM move Q instruction I'm fetching, and while I'm fetching it, I'm doing the memory stage for an add, all of a sudden our add instruction is writing to memory when it's not supposed to. Because we read an RM move Q instruction and passed the values in from an add, one of them happens to be the input to the instruction to the data memory, now we're writing for the add instruction because we happen to refetch a memory writing instruction while we were doing its memory stage, which normally should do nothing. So we have this problem that the value the instruction memory is outputting, the I code, it's an I code for an instruction. It tells us what an instruction is, but it's not the instruction we care about for the data memory. It's not the instruction we're working on in that part of the processor. So we need to get a copy of the I code for the instruction we're actually working on. And following the rule I told you earlier, if in a pipeline stage, I'm going to get information from the previous stage through a register. So we're going to get our I code, the actual one for the instruction, we're going to have that be passed to us from the previous stage, from the execute stage in this case. And the execute stage, well, it doesn't know get the I code directly from the instruction memory because that's still a different instruction. So it's going to get it passed to it from the decode stage. The decode stage, well, it can't read the instruction memory isn't a part of it. It's not going to read it. So it's going to get passed from the fetch stage. And in the fetch stage, if we want to get the I code, we just get it out of the instruction memory. That's okay in the fetch stage because that's where we use the instruction memory. It's where we actually read the I code in the first place. So we're going to have this chain of registers in front of this logic which decides whether we read or write the memory, to make sure that the I code we're looking at is the one that we fetched when we fetched this instruction, not when we fetch some future instruction. And this sort of thing might give you an idea why people have trouble debugging pipeline processors. If you think about how this bug manifests, kind of ugly. So this means that you're going to take code like this. So this is the code, you might have for your single cycle processor in HCL. You look at the I code, which comes from I10 bytes, the output of the instruction memory, and set, mem read bit to 1, sometimes 0, other times. When you do the pipeline version, you're not going to look at I code anymore, the output of the instruction memory. Instead, you're going to get the output of the instruction memory in fetch, pass it to a register, which gets passed through into code and execute and so on. And you're going to read the output of the register for memory to figure out what the instruction is. And this is true of all our control logic. And for the most part, I code is the big thing you need to know, and the big thing we didn't show you on that picture of, what gets passed through between pipeline stages. We always need the I code because pretty much every single stage we need to make some decision about what to do, what mux input goes to the mux output somewhere based on the I code of the instruction we're running. So we'll just pass the I code all the way through, and you access the I code for your current stage and not a different stage. So if you're in fetch, you can get the output of the instruction memory. Every other stage, that's the wrong thing. It could be a different kind of instruction. And you don't want to happen to write memory because you're fetching a write memory instruction even though you have the values for an add. So that's our general pattern for building our control logic for pipeline code. And we also talked about figuring out what's in pipeline registers. So another way to figure out your logic and what's in pipeline registers, more systematically than just trying to draw a picture with all the muxes and such on it, is to go through our textbook's description of what instructions do stage by stage. Here, they're probably considerably more useful than they are for the single cycle processor, even though they're helpful there too. So I can look at this description, and I have lines drawn for each of the pipeline registers we're going to have. And I know from where we started that we're going to pass the I/O code all the way through, because every single thing this does in our full processor, we're going to need the I/O code to decide, am I running an instruction where I do, this addition or not? We're going to need the I/O code to decide whether any of these things happen. So in addition, we can look at the values that are used. So for example, we see RA and RB are set in fetch, and we can look at everywhere they're used, and we can say, okay, RB is set in fetch, it's used in write back. So everything in between, every pipeline register in between, needs to pass RB because it needs to go stage by stage by stage. So that's how you can figure out, okay, I need RB everywhere. We do the same for RA. RA is used in decode. It's set and fetch, so everything in between, which is just one set of pipeline registers, needs to have RA. And we can repeat this process for every single value that is assigned. So you can see val A and val B are set into code and used in execute, so they need to be in the registers in between. Yes?
Is that just a thing?
Which?
Execute.
What in the execute?
Val B.
Yes, that is just a typo.
Okay.
Val A. Don't know how I didn't catch that one. Yes, it's supposed to do what an add actually does. And we do the same thing for Val E. Val E is set and execute, used in writeback. So every set of pipeline registers in between, which is execute to memory, memory to write back, needs to have val E. And note that doesn't matter here, that for example, the memory stage doesn't do anything. It still needs to do a little bit of work, which is passing a value that it got from execute to write back. And that's typical of what every single stage is gonna end up doing. A whole bunch of lines of code in your HCL are gonna be doing that. Okay. We're going to do a little bit of a change to this most straightforward description, typically. So we're going to set something I'm going to call desti. We're going to have that value be computed in decode and passed through. This is going to make our pipeline implementation easier, but it's not actually necessary. Like, this desti value is redundant with RB and I code. Like, that tells us the same stuff that having this explicitly set desti value does. But that's something I'm going to do in my pipeline implementations just because it's going to make handling some situations easier. It's not actually necessary. You can do whatever actually is equivalent. But it's going to end up being easier to have this desti around rather than RB. So this is our general process for figuring out what goes in pipeline registers. And also, you can read the steps at each stage, and basically, that's HCL code right there. You can translate it directly to HCL code. And that gives you your whole processor. So you just go through every single instruction, do muxes for the cases where what you do depends on the I code, which is most of these steps. So you have, if I code equals opq, you do this stuff. If it equals pushq, you do something else. And then you'll have your whole pipeline processor. Yeah, so you can just go through other instructions, figure this out, figure out the same thing. You can say, okay, we need array here, so array must be passed. And if you already did add key, you say, oh, don't need to do anything extra. You can say, oh, I need val A and val B. Okay, well, I was already passing val A and val B from decode to execute. Oh, I also need to pass it to memory. That's something to add. And you can just accumulate all the things that go in the pipeline register this way. And you can see val E, which we already had from add, just to go there. This also illustrates the first reason why I recommend doing the desti thing, because it makes this actually even more similar to add, as far as what we do. Now it isn't a special case, RSP isn't a special case we deal with in write back. But you don't have to do that, because you could just leave it as before and assume you use the iCode to figure that out. So any questions about this process of building our HCL for our straightforward pipeline implementation? Or any of the things I've done? I'm going to move on to hazards next, and it's helpful if you actually understand what's going on here when we talk about hazards. Yes? Okay, so the question is, like, what does a mux for one of these look like? So, for example, we might have valley equals, so this would be the execute output. So execute output valley equals if execute input iCode is opq, you do the, you know, valet op valb. If it's push q, you do valb minus 8. So the question is there a default case too? If you handle every single instruction, you don't need one. Our muxes will default to having 1:0 at the end effectively. But if you handle every instruction, it doesn't matter. You can write one though, and it's handy often to write a default case, which is something like 1:OX bad or something like that. So that's a useful thing to do for debugging, because that means if you ever see the values bad in a register, you know something went wrong. Whereas if you just make the default case be 0, you might not realize that. Okay. So with hopefully some idea, you'll have a lot more practice when you actually do our HCL assignments. Let's talk about hazards. So you're going to start with the easiest to understand, I think, kind of hazard, which is a data hazard. So here I have two instructions. I do add R8 to R9, and then add R9 to R8. And what we expect to happen is that we read the initial values, so here in this case 800 and 900, add them together, get 1700, store that. Then we read the new value, that's 1700, and add that to 800 and store that in R8. But if we execute this in the pipeline I showed you earlier, we're going to end up reading 900 in the second instruction, not the value that was computed by the previous instruction. And that's because, yeah, we have that value, but it hasn't been set to the register file yet. It's not ready. So we're going to read the wrong value. And this is called a data hazard. A hazard is a case where if we do the straightforward thing in our pipeline, we get the wrong answer. So basically what's happening is our instruction set specification says we do this instruction, then the next instruction, and so on. And it says that we read R8 and R9, then write R9. We read R9 and R8, then write R8. And our implementation is reading R8 and R9, reading R9 and R8, then writing R9, then writing R8. So our implementation doesn't agree with the specification, it's wrong. So we're just not doing what the instruction set says instructions do. So we're going to have several solutions to this. Today we're just going to talk about some simple solutions. So I'm going to start with the simplest for hardware manufacturer solution. So the simplest solution if you're making hardware for this problem is to say, well, if you want to do this, really you should have inserted some nums. Say, I'm going to change my instruction set specification. So right now, I've written down add, reads two registers and stores their value. Instead, I could write down add, reads two registers, then two instructions later, stores their value. That's an option I have, and then the compiler can work with that new specification, and when it wants to do an add and then use the value, it's going to insert some nums or some other work to do. Well, this is a real option that you have. People don't like it very much. Makes it really hard to write assembly. Makes it a little bit harder to write compilers. So usually this is not acceptable, but there have been real architectures which have chosen this option. Just said, this is the way we're dealing with data hazards. We're going to tell you how long instructions take to actually write values, and you need to handle that. Most people don't like this, but it's a workable solution, and it's really easy on the hardware implementation. So if we're not going to do that, you know, if we're going to provide the same interface because our compiler writers are going to get really angry at us if we ask them to insert nops for us, now, what do we do instead? So the simplest thing to do, the easiest solution, is that the hardware should insert some nops for them. It should do the equivalent as if they had those nops. It should, instead of reading the next out instruction and running that, it should just run a nop and then run another nop until we're ready with the value that the second add needs. And this is called stalling. And the way we're going to implement this is with some extra logic. So we need some logic to say, okay, sometimes we're not going to change the program counter. We're just going to stay with the current instruction, which is not ready to run yet, but we need to remember what it is when we are ready to run it. And we also need some logic to, instead of sending out the values from that instruction, instead of saying, read from R9, write to R8, saying, do a nop right now. So we need something to replace the instruction we read with a nop. And when you've implemented this, you get sort of an execution trace like this, where we load the second instruction, but we send a nop down the pipeline, which we can represent by sending 15 down the pipeline, our do-nothing register number. That's the register to write in, that will make it a nop. So you just send that down the pipeline until we know that when we send the instruction down the pipeline, it will read the updated value. So you wait long enough that the write will have finished by the time we enter the decode stage. And this would be done with extra logic in the hardware that figures out when do I need to send from fetch to decode a nop and when can I actually move forward with the current instruction and advance the program counter and so on. And well, we've made our program slower, but at least we're getting the right answer. So another way of looking at this, what we're doing here, is not in terms of what goes in the pipeline registers, but another view is what's running in each stage. So you can think of this as we run the first add normally, it goes from fetch to decode to execute to write back. The second one, we keep in fetch, which is keeping the PC the same and not sending anything, sending a nop out to the decode stage until we're ready, and then we send it on and we advance normally. This picture makes sense how it's equivalent to what I showed you before? People nodding, seems okay. So this is another view. Sometimes it would be more convenient to reason about what happens with instructions in this view. And speaking of this view, there's another option that I didn't show you, the pipeline registers version, which is equivalent that we might want to do. So sometimes we won't know that these instructions conflict in the fetch stage. Maybe we can't figure it out yet, or we don't want to put the extra logic in the fetch stage to figure it out. So we might decide in the decode stage, hey, I can't make progress. I can't read the right value yet. So another option is we fetch the second instruction, we send it to decode, and in decode we decide, nope, can't make progress, and we keep that instruction in decode. And in order to do that without losing an instruction, we also keep the instruction we just fetched in fetch. So we effectively kept two things the same until we're ready to advance the thing into code. So this has the same effects as far as what's visible outside, and it's something you might choose to do. It lets you make the decision later in the pipeline. And you could implement either. Yes? The question is, how do you know when to stall and not to stall? We'll talk about that a bit later. But the short answer is you're going to look at the things you have in pipeline registers, or going to pipeline registers. You're going to look at register numbers, you're going to look at instruction codes, and figure out, do these things need a stall based on that? And we'll talk about the specific kinds of stalls we're going to need to implement and what the logic is for them. Okay. So now that we've talked about data hazards, here's an exercise. So I showed you sort of the logic where we figure out, you know, what happens in each stage, when we need to stall. So here's some code for this IQ processor. And I want to resolve these data hazards with stalling. How many stalls do I need to execute this and get the right answer? So figure this out. I strongly recommend writing out what's in each stage when, because I make off by one errors basically every single time when I don't do that. It will really help figure it out. So figure out what you think your answer is, compare with your neighbors, see if you agree. I'll give you a couple minutes. Okay, who thinks they have an answer to this question? Just an answer. Who think an answer? I'm not asking for volunteers to give your answer. Just saying who thinks they've answered the question in a way. Okay, so by a show of hands, who thinks the answer is zero? This was a trick question. Why did you ask it? Okay, how about one? Okay, some people. Two? Okay, some people, about half and half for one and two, three or more, a couple people. Okay, so let me go through how I go about solving this. So the first thing when I have a problem like this is I want to figure out where can we have hazards? Where do we have instructions that depend on each other? And so the question for the types of hazards we can have with stall, with add is, where am I reading a value that I just wrote? So I can identify all the dependencies here. So these are the things which might cause our hazards. We need to send the value from R9, needs to somehow, that's written to R9, needs to somehow get to the instruction which reads it. And the same thing for R11. So then from that, the next step I would usually take is I start writing out each instruction and say, okay, we have the R8, R9 instruction, so it's in fetch, then decode, then execute, then write back, then the R10, R11 instruction is in fetch, then decode, then execute, and write back. I would write it out something like this so I can figure out how do these things interact as far as when do we read and write. So I have that we're now here along with this solution. So if I were writing things out naturally, I'd want to put this at our 9 or 8. I just want to, I would ideally, you know, it would be nice if we could end up executing it here. But we can see that that doesn't work because we need to communicate this R9 value, which is written at the end of write back. Remember that rising edge of the clock after write back is when R9 is going to change. And we would naturally be trying to read it before it's written if we didn't have any stall. So if we didn't have any stalling, here would be where our decode stage would be. That would be when we'd be trying to read it, which would be just before it would be written by the first instruction. So to deal with that, we need to stall once, which is just long enough so it's written and then immediately afterwards we read it. So that's that one stall, which I've marked with an red X. So then we have another dependency, which is from our second add instruction into R11, reading here. So there, after we've done that stalling, it ends up that we write at the end of cycle 4 and read during cycle 5, everything's fine. That's fine because this one stall delayed both of the two instructions. So most of you who got two probably had this reasonable reasoning that, hey, there's a dependency here and they're separated by one other instruction, so we need to add additional knob. And there's two of those, so that's two knobs, two stalls. But the problem is that this one stall changed when both instructions were, and so it was enough. So generally, if we ask you questions like this, you want to figure out what's going on, it's really helpful to draw out the picture so you can figure out when situations like that happen, which is very common. Yes?
So in this case, there is no memory particular stage?
Because the processor I show you doesn't have a data memory at all and doesn't have any those pipeline registers, yes. So if there was memory, then you might get an answer like 3 or more. Would not be unimaginable. But because the pipeline I'm showing you on the slide is not that, it doesn't work that way. Okay. So any other questions about this exercise? Okay. So now that we know about hazards and stalling, so solving a simple solution for hazards, it always works for data hazards, it always fixes them. We just wait long enough, it's gonna be fine. So we can look at how this affects our actual pipeline performance. So stalling is a case where we're losing performance over the ideal of pipelining. So our ideal of pipelining is we finish one instruction a cycle, and now because we're doing pipelining, our cycle time is much, much lower. But because of stalling, we aren't necessarily doing one instruction a cycle. So first, let's see, like, if you know what happens in a program, how bad is this? And a common statistic we're going to use to evaluate pipelines is cycles per instruction. This is a measure of sort of how efficiently the pipeline is dealing with things like hazards. So with the pipelines we've discussed, ideally, we'd have no hazards to worry about, and we get one cycle per instruction. But that's not going to be reality. Sometimes we're going to need to stall. So let's say I run a program and I measure how often things stall, and I get that 1% of the instructions I need to stall for 4 cycles, 2% stall for exactly 3, and so on. So given that, what's my average cycles per instruction? Figure it out. I'll give you a minute or two. Thank you. Okay, anyone volunteer to describe to me what the formula for this looks like? You? So you weigh each by, so what is the, what's the, like the formula calculation end up being? Okay, so you say that 15% take 2 cycles, 10% takes 3 cycles, and so on, and you also compute the number which take 1 cycle, which is everything that doesn't stall. And hopefully there's nothing which stalls for, that isn't included here. Yeah, so that's a valid way of doing it. Just figure out how many take 1 cycle, how many takes 2, and so on. This is what I did. I say everything takes 1 cycle, 15% take an additional 1, 10% take an additional 2, and so on. But it's an equivalent calculation, you'll get the same answer. Both are valid ways of thinking about it. So you see here that we have some stalling happening, and our pipeline processor isn't finishing just one instruction every cycle like the ideal. It's finishing a lot less on average. And to figure out how much this actually matters, we need to look at about cycle time. So when we make our pipeline processor, if we have like 5 stages, we presumably reduce the cycle time by a lot. And like something which might happen is we have 5 stages, maybe we reduce the cycle time by a factor of 4, because things don't divide up quite evenly, and we have pipeline register delays, all those things we talked about when we talked about pipelining in general. So we have some imperfect case here. So how much better is our throughput in this case? What we do, well, we say, okay, so we're computing on average, the average time between completion of instructions is 1.45 cycles per instruction times 1 cycle every 300 picoseconds, so it's 435 picoseconds, and with our single cycle processor, every 1200 picoseconds we finish an instruction. So that gives us how much faster we are. And a thing to note about this sort of calculation is that the amount of time we stalled mattered a lot. It's a big factor. And that depends on what kinds of programs you run. I can write a program where there's a data hazard or some other hazard between every single pair of instruction, every single construction. And if I have a program like that, it's going to run a lot slower. It's going to get a lot less benefit from pipelining. And in the worst case, because our original pipelining addition didn't perfectly reduce the cycle time, it could end up running slower than on our single cycle processor. We're depending that most programs don't have hazards all over the place in order to actually get a benefit from our pipeline processor. But typically that's actually the case. We'll actually have programs which don't have hazards everywhere that we need to stall for. So, talked about data hazards, which are the most straightforward kind of hazard, and our simplest possible way of dealing with data hazards, which is stalling. Next time, not today, we'll talk about a better solution for some data hazards, but not all of them. But there's another type of hazards, which are control hazards. And these are a bit more nefarious than data hazards. So for data hazards, we at least know what we need to do. We're just waiting for a value. Control hazards are what we call it when we don't even know what instruction we need to run. So for example, in this code, we do an add, and that add's gonna set some condition codes, and depending on what those are, we're either gonna go to the add that follows this conditional jump, or to whatever is at address 0xFFFF. And if we look at what's in our pipeline registers, we don't even know what the result of the add is yet. By the time we need to compute, figure out what the jump needs to do. And our condition codes, because we haven't done the add yet, aren't set for the right value. If you read those registers, we're not going to get the right thing. So we don't even know what PC to fetch next. And we can solve this hazard just like the other hazard by stalling. We can wait until the condition codes are going to be updated, And when they are, we can finally finish the jump instruction and start executing whatever needs to execute after it. So that means just like with the add, we need to spend some number of cycles waiting for SFCF, you know, our condition codes to update, you know, to tell us what the jump actually needs to do. And so looking at our other view of this, we can say what's in each instruction. And the way I'm going to write this is that I'm going to say that the jump goes through the cycles, but we wait for the jump to get finish its execute before we decide what to run next. So that's our stall. So we send our jump all the way through, and finally, when we're in the memory stage, we use the value it just got from execute and use that to decide what instruction to execute next. And while we're waiting for it, we need to stall because we don't know what to do. We have to wait, figure out, you know, wait for it to actually finish enough of its execution that we know what to run next. So this is, you know, dealing with that hazard with stall. So jump, conditional jumps are one instruction where we have this problem, we don't know what to do next. There's another one, you know, besides conditional jumps, where we have to wait until later in order to get the signal about what to run next, and that's RET. So in RET, we need to read the address to jump to from the data memory, and with the way our pipeline works, we're going to do that reading in the memory stage. And you might say, well, that seems silly. Why can't we do it earlier? And the biggest problem with trying to do it earlier is that sometimes it's not going to be written until the memory stage of the previous instruction. So in the worst case, you know, there's no shortcut. So our return instruction is going to go all the way, you know, through every single stage. From fetch to decode to execute, it's going to do its memory stage, it's going to read the place we need to go, and then in the next cycle, we're able to actually start fetching that instruction. And so we have some path where we send the result that we read from memory into the PC, and while we're doing that, we have some logic which is going to wait. It's not going to advance the PC, we're going to just be waiting, and we're just going to send out nops because we don't know what instruction to run, and we don't want to run ret multiple times. So this idea makes sense, these two stalling for control hazards. So a notable thing here is why that we're stalling, you know, why can't we take some shortcut? And we're going to have sort of a revised picture of our pipeline stages and sort of explain why we do things exactly the way we do, even though it seems like maybe we could stall for less cycles by doing something clever. So you notice that here, you know, we've changed things, so we just do most PC computation in the fetch stage. So we're doing all the common cases, all the no control flow cases are done in the fetch stage, but we have something conditional, we're doing that later. And part of the reason we're doing that later is that, well, we've decided that we read condition codes in the execute stage, and we need to read them in the execute stage because they're going to be written by the previous execute stage. And a way we can avoid data hazards in our pipeline is by always reading and writing things in the same stage. Because if we always read in the execute stage, we know that if we're in the execute stage, all the instructions that came before us already did their execute stage. The reason we had data hazards is because we were reading something into code and writing it right back in different stages. But if we can avoid doing that, we won't have any data hazard problems. So by always saying we always access the condition codes from execute, we don't have to worry about data hazards with the condition codes. We always know whatever version we're reading is the version that this instruction is getting from the previous instruction if it updated it, and we're not seeing like updates from some future instruction or anything like that. And the same thing is going to be true of memory. So we read and write memory in the same cycle. This means we don't need to worry about reading something from memory that hasn't been written by another instruction yet. We know that won't happen because if we're in the memory stage, every instruction that before us that wrote something to memory already completed the memory stage, already wrote the value. We're going to read the latest thing from memory. If we didn't do that, if like we had a read memory stage after the code and the write memory stage later, we'd have to worry about data hazards with values in memory. We don't want to do that. And that's part of the way why our pipeline does things the way when it does. And we also have this extra step we haven't talked about before, which is the stat register. So you've been using the stat register in your HTL assignments. It decides whether we halt. We need to write the stat register in the write-back stage. You know, it's tempting to say, let's do it earlier, because I know everything I need to know about the stat register in the fetch stage. I've looked at the instruction. I know whether or not it's valid. I know whether or not it's a halt. So why don't I just set it earlier? Well, if I set it earlier, then when I halt, I won't finish those other instructions. So if you look at the registers, there'll be the registers from before the halt instruction was supposed to run. And that's not the sort of contract we expect. If I have an invalid instruction, you'll get an invalid instruction, but you'll see registers from the wrong point in time. You'll see registers that don't reflect everything up to the invalid instruction. And that's not what we want to provide. So we're going to wait until the write-back stage to actually write the stat register so everything else can finish up. So any questions about any place we've placed these operations and stages, why we can't take real shortcuts here, even though, you know, we want to read the condition codes earlier for conditional jumps, for example. Okay, so we've looked at the PC update here, operations, and we've talked about stalling. And if we're stalling on the PC update, what does that actually look like as far as logic? How do I modify the processor I have to do that? So here's like what our PC update looks like now. We have our normal instruction plus something. We have our other cases, like where we're getting jump targets and such. And we need to add stalling to this. And also getting jump targets from somewhere else. So one way of doing this is that when we stall, we want to keep running the same thing. That just means take the output of the PC, feed it back into the PC. So we have a mux where we either take the instruction plus its length or the current instruction address, and we use whichever one is appropriate depending on whether or not we want to stall. So I haven't shown you here, you know, some control logic which decides whether we need to stall, but you know, we can talk about that later. And we also have some case where we get a jump target or a return address that's going to be from elsewhere in the pipeline, and we have control logic which is going to figure out when that's happening. And so it's going to pass it through. So this is, I think, the easiest to understand version of how we do our PC update with a pipeline processor, is that we have something like this, and the control logic is going to need to look at like where is the return instruction if we're running one, where is the conditional jump instruction to figure out which option to choose. This is not quite what our textbook does. So our textbook just rearranges this slightly. So you could implement this and it would work, but it's not what's in our textbook. What's in our textbook is that they've moved this mux here after the program counter register. So instead of having a program counter register, they have what they call a predicted program counter register, which is the usual value of the PC in the normal case. So it's the PC plus whatever value, or it's a stall value. That's what their predicted PC is. So either you stall or you predict the actual next instruction. And after it, they have logic which possibly takes in a jump target or possibly decides takes in a return address or so on. This is just moving where the register is in this. So they just move the register from before the, they move the PC register from after this to before it. So it's in the middle, but the same process is happening. We've just split the PC update. So some of it happens at the beginning of the fetch stage, and some of it happens at the end. That's all we've done here. So this is what our textbook does. And in the process of doing it, our register no longer stores the actual next PC. It stores a prediction of what it usually is. But sometimes we override that because we know, oh, we look in our pipeline registers and we say, oh, I'm running a return. I better get the return address, and so on. So with this rearranged PC update in HCL code, this means that what we're setting the PC to is not going to be, you know, you're following your textbook, not going to be the value of the PC register, but it's going to be some mux where sometimes we input the jump target, sometimes we input some other things, and usually we input the value of this predicted PC register. That's the default, that's the common case. Okay, this rearranging makes sense. Questions? I'm sure it will come up later, but I'd like to try to get any questions I can get now before we have the assignment on it. Okay, so this is the way our textbook does things, so both ways are valid. Most people will probably implement what the textbook says, but we're going to test that you implement the pipeline processor correctly, not that you implement it exactly the way the textbook tells you to. Okay, so one thing you might ask, based on what I've just shown you, is, well, if we're allowed to make decisions about what exactly the PC should be before we do send something to the instruction memory in the fetch phase, why are we reading a value from the data memory and then waiting till the next cycle to actually use it? You know, if we decided that it's okay that we send a value in from directly into the data memory. So what's the problem with this? Why did the textbook authors not choose to do this? So I'll give a clearer idea of what this looks like. So right now, what our textbook's design does is we take the output of the data memory, it goes through the pipeline registers, and from that pipeline register, that's how it gets into the instruction memory. So we could rewire this, where we just skip around the pipeline register and just send the value directly. And this would be functional. It would work correctly. Why did the textbook authors not do this? They had a good reason. You know, it's not about correctness, so it must be about something else, like performance. So what's the problem with doing this? How would you start reasoning about how this change changes the performance of our pipeline processor? So there are two factors for the performance of our pipeline processor. So one of them is how much do we stall? This is going to reduce the amount of stalling we do. Seems like an improvement. Another of them is how long is our cycle time? And how long our cycle time depends on the critical path. What's the slowest path from a pipeline register to a pipeline register? And that's where we have a problem. So if we do this, this is likely what our critical path's going to be. We have to go through the data memory, and then go through the instruction memory, and then go through the instruction length adding thing in a single cycle. And that's likely to make our cycle time really high. And that's not worth getting rid of a cycle of stalling on every return. It's going to be far, far worse for performance because our programs aren't just like a series of return statements. They were, maybe you want to do this, but they generally aren't. So this is a bad idea, and that's why our textbook authors didn't do it. And a general thing in pipelining is that, well, we could have just done the single cycle thing. We're not doing it because for a reason. And the way things are split up is about getting the right sort of performance trade-off. That, you know, because we're going to have to stall sometimes, there is a trade-off there in what we decide to put in each stage. And they've made a particular choice based on what should give us good performance. So any questions about this? Where we talk about a little bit about implementing stalling. So we talked about our some cases where we might want to stall. It turns out we won't stall in all of them, but I'm going to talk generally about what does the logic look like for stalling. And I showed you that earlier for the PC. Our logic for stalling, our predicted PC, is that we have this mux where sometimes we send through a signal which says, keep the old value. We just send in the old value, we just have a loop. Output of the register to the input. And that's how we stall. That's how we keep us doing the same thing the next cycle, because the next cycle now will output the same thing instead of the new thing. The other thing we have to do, we're going to call bubbling. And that's inserting a knob. We're going to call that inserted knob a bubble in the pipeline. And to do that, we just have a mux where we have the constant, which is whatever value represents a knob. In HCL, that's generally going to be whatever your default value is. And we have this mux which decides, do we send in the value that represents a knob, or do we send in what we're normally sending in? So you just add that everywhere where we might need to insert a knob in the pipeline. So it turns out that, you know, this is something that you know how to implement this in HCL now. You can write muxes that represent this. You could do this. And certainly we could do this by hand, but our HCL tool has this built in to every single register bank. All the muxes are already there for you. You don't have to write them. So if you have a register bank, there's one signal that will control stall muxes, so muxes which take in the old value, for every single register in that register bank. And there's another one which will control bubble muxes, so that's something that will give the default value for every single register in that register bank. So this is generally how you're going to deal with any case where you need to stall, and some other things we'll talk about later. So it's very handy to know this. Now, this is unfortunately something which confuses people. People are confused, and like I've shown you the picture of the muxes, it's kind of conceptually simple, but people always have trouble reasoning about what am I actually doing, when do I actually need to set things to stall or bubble. What does it mean? So let's start with an exercise. So I've told you what happens. So when the stall signal was set, we're inputting the old value. When the bubble signal was set, we're inputting the default value. So given that, I've given you a timeline and some HCL code that shows you how the register bank is declared. So what's actually going to end up being the values here? So figure that out, check if your neighbors agree on what those values are. Thank you. Okay, who has this, who's done with this question? Who's not, who still needs a bunch more time? Okay, I'm afraid I'm minority. I'll display the solution, you can check. So general strategy here, and the thing which confuses people the most, biggest thing, that's the point of confusion, is that the default thing which happens is I set the input, and that's the output in the next cycle. That's the most important thing to know. So by default, and by not stalling or bubbling, input goes is the output in the next cycle. It's how the register works. And stalling is effectively preventing my input from doing anything. So every single time we stall, my input doesn't do anything. And things stay the way they were. We feed back the old value, that's what happens. Every time I bubble, I basically replace the input I have with the default. So that's the reasoning. So hopefully you can remember this. We'll have some more practice with what happens here. So you're going to use these signals, for example, when you need to implement stalling, you need to set stall for some of the register banks and bubble for others, depending on whether you want to, for example, keep the PC the same, or keep the current instruction that's in decode the same, or whether you want to send a NOP, which is hopefully your default values, down the pipeline. And it's a big source of confusion, like, when do you set that? So the first thing you need to know is, what does it actually do? And then we can talk about, next time we'll talk about reasoning about how does that correspond to what should be in the pipeline registers. Start with that. And also go through, given that we know how it corresponds to pipeline registers, some other ways besides stalling of dealing with hazards. So in the interest of keeping sync with the other class, that's probably where I'm going to stop. So any questions on anything, bubbling, stalling, pipeline division? Nope, not yet. So see you all on Thursday, and see your TAs in the lab on Wednesday. Yeah.